Welcome to Digital Marketing That Puts People First, brought to you by The Online Co., where we believe the best way to help businesses grow is to do exactly that, put people first. I'm James Parnwell, and in this episode we have Beth and Lucy from Hope Media. Since Hope Media's establishment as the Christian Broadcasting Association in 1953, they have grown and adapted to the ever-changing media environment. Today they are partners with a number of radio stations around the country, the largest of which is Hope 103.2 in Sydney, which is the largest community radio station in Australia with approximately 800,000 listeners per month. Lucy works as brand manager for Hope Media. She's a business management degree from City University in London and has spent over a decade working for not-for-profit organisations while consulting for other companies. Along the way, she also taught herself graphic design. With her wealth of experience, Lucy believes that marketing has undergone significant changes in recent years. However, she's not convinced that everyone in the marketing industry has caught up on these changes just yet. Beth is an experienced digital content manager with an impressive background in not-for-profit and broadcast media industries. She's a skilled journalist and radio professional with expertise in media relations, crisis management, and event management. She graduated from Codemaster Institute in West Australia with a certificate in full-stack web development, bringing a well-rounded digital skill set to the table. With experience in writing and editing for a national print and online publication, Beth is a strong media and communications professional. She holds a Bachelor of Arts in Communications and Cultural Studies with a focus on journalism and creative writing from Curtin University of Technology in West Australia. Beth and Lucy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, James.
Well, I'd like to get started with you telling us a little bit about yourself. Perhaps, Lucy, you can tell us a little bit about your history and why did you even bother deciding on marketing?
That's a great question, because at one point in my university degree, I think I had a existential crisis about the ethics of marketing, and I think I very nearly left the industry entirely. So I started, obviously I went to university and did a business management degree with a focus on marketing, but I was very unconvinced about the type of marketing that was out there at the time, especially for not-for-profits. There was significant amount of emotional fatigue and possible manipulation in the advertising that was happening. I actually thought that marketing was quite lazy at times, and people had a little bit too much budget and weren't quite as creative as they could have been. So I was getting a bit unimpressed with the industry when I left.
Sure.
And I decided to move into the not-for-profit sector purely because it allowed for that challenge. Say you reduce a budget, suddenly you have to become creative in other areas. And so I really enjoy a challenge. I really enjoy looking at things differently. I love the fact that marketing is communicating the right thing to the right person at the right time. And I think that you have to be able to read people really well to do that. And I kind of just began to explore what marketing could look like, and it was really the not-for-profit sector and the challenges involved in that sector and where I thought we could improve that kind of moved me there at that time.
So Beth, how about yourself? How did you get involved with marketing?
I probably don't have as much as, well, I definitely don't have as much marketing background as Lucy, but just in the digital media communication side of things, I do have a little bit of a similar story to her in that, I mean, who knows what you want to do when you're, you know, recently graduated from school and you're a teenager and you have to choose a life path. So I wanted to be an author actually, but I was smart enough to know I couldn't become an author immediately. I thought that I would study, journalism because I was like, well, I get to write and I get to get paid if I can get a job. And I was fortunate enough to get a job immediately at a state newspaper. However, I did start when newspaper print journalism was on the decline. So that was probably not so smart a decision. But I got to see the rise of social media from the very beginning. And I think, you know, a bit similar with Lucy, like I kind of went in a bit naive to commercial media, thinking that I guess all journalists, you know, we want to change the world with our writing. And then you end up writing celebrity and dog stories and, you know, not yes. so much of all the really hard-hitting things.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, and I do remember watching social media and online journalism take over from the print revenue. And so we all were in a time where redundancies across Australia in print journalism was happening, not just like, you know, week by week and day by day and individual. It was, you know, a newspaper was cutting 500 people, an organization was cutting 200 people. It was a bit of a depressing time. And I was just starting my career. So I think how I got into it is, one, I got heaps of marketing experience because it was for a major media corporation. You got that by default. They expected you to learn whatever you had to learn. I remember when Facebook came in and all of a sudden they were like, all right, you all have to go to a workshop to learn how to send photos from your Nokia mobile to the editor when a story comes through. And we were actually all horrified because we were like, well, that's the photojournalist job. We're writers, you know. And so I think it was like along the way, they just kept teaching us things that we were learning by accident that now people natively know. And you know, in the beginning of Facebook pages to market a business. And for us, it was like we had lots of different publications within the paper, and then they all had to have their separate Facebook pages. And then we had to start building audiences, but we also had to start building our own brand as a person. So you were supposed to have, like, you know, at the time it was Twitter. So you were supposed to be building your own Twitter brand. And I think these days, Lucy will probably speak into this more, whether or not personal versus company brand, like how that all fits. But at the beginning, I don't know, people were just muddling their way through. And anything that new, you were supposed to jump onto it and figure out how it worked and start doing it for yourself so that it could help the other organization, the organization, sorry, you're working for. So I think, yeah, just in the beginnings, I wanted to be a writer, and I kind of fell into loving online media. I remember when they launched their website and you started to get to write for online. And I just loved the fact that at that time they used to have comments below the stories and you got to interact in real time with audience. Whereas if it was a newspaper, you had to wait for them to write a letter to the editor, they'd print it. Maybe you'd get a phone call of abuse. I don't know. But I loved how immediate online was and how you could fix things if you needed to. You could put up stories immediately. And so I think from there as well, that was where like a love of digital media started and just grew into all the different, you know, whichever media space I've been in, it's always been digital first. As a passion.
So it's interesting when I talk to marketing people that some people come from a comms background and other people come from a tech background or the other is kind of a business background. And you guys seem to have quite a mixture of all of the above. So Beth, you've done a Bachelor of Arts in communications, but you've done web dev as well. But Lucy, you've done business with marketing. And then you guys are now working together. So you've got quite diverse backgrounds and the unifying thing is potentially not for profit. How do you find those skills, Lucy, when you're working with Beth and maybe other people, you know, those different skills complementing, and when you see your strengths and weaknesses and the need to draw on other people?
I think myself and Beth, we're really fortunate in the way that we work together because our skills are complementary, but actually don't necessarily overlap always. And as a result of that, we really respect the skill sets that the other people come from. I will be getting something ready to create into a campaign, and I will definitely say, Beth, okay, could you check my grammar? Because Beth comes from a communication background. and always gives me some fun facts about, you know, what I've missed out or didn't know about grammar in general. But that's
that she didn't ask for.
yeah, that I didn't ask for. So that's on a very basic level. But I think when you work, when you come from different backgrounds, you actually end up finding that your skills are complementary. Beth is very much focused on digital content-led marketing. And I'm very much focused on brand marketing, more of an overview, possibly maybe even a slightly bigger picture. But then we both can sometimes cross over into each other's roles. And I think it's just respecting the skills that each other's have and actually working together. And so I actually very much appreciate that a lot of the skills that Beth have are the ones that don't overlap are things that I would struggle with if it was just me. So I think that's what happens when you bring people from differing backgrounds into a similar role. And it's actually really smart, a really good way of doing it.
Yeah. So Beth, as a journalist and a budding novelist, you went out and studied web dev, which is,
yes,
you know, logic and data and, you know, code.
Yeah.
How does that, did that break your brain or did it, how did that work for you?
I think weirdly, not weirdly, coding is another language, but weirdly okay. They fit together really well. I think I've always been someone who just wants to stay relevant in a job, in the sense of I started out my career at a time when I actually have fully personally experienced the decline of an industry. And I think that, you know, the jobs that are of the future of maybe 5 or 10 years time and how we will market things, we don't even know about yet. And so I think like my experience just starting out as a very young person at the beginning of my career and watching an entire industry change because of one tool. It was essentially Twitter that changed print journalism into online journalism. Yeah. And so for that reason, I think it's more just like a passion in me to always make sure I have skills that are relevant to a role. But I also just enjoy learning something new and never being bored, to be honest. So I think that the studying coding part came in because I feel like a lot of people actually start to learn things like HTML and CSS by accident anyway. You might go into a job and they'll start teaching you some things and then you realize you actually have some of those skills later. And that's what happened to me when I worked for a university editing for them. And so I think it was just more like a real interest in going, hey, like how does digital spaces work? Like, what are they built on? And I think when I found out it was just another language, I was just really interested in like learning a new language. It just happened to be a digital language.
Okay. So we have this saying, digital marketing that puts people first, and it's a philosophy of ours at The Online Co. What does marketing and people and that, you know, the ethics of that mean to you, Lucy?
It's actually everything. I think one of the biggest shifts and transitions in marketing over probably the last 20 years is we started off marketing, working out what we wanted to say to people and then saying it. What did we want them to hear? And then we started communicating that in whatever way we could. For a lot of the old school marketing campaigns, you have this manifesto that you're sharing about who you are with the world. But we live in the world and the world started to shift with the internet and everything else coming on board. Suddenly we have the informed consumer model, which essentially is anything. Don't just tell someone who you are and expect them to believe it. If people want to know something about your organization, they're going to find out about your organization. It's called the internet and we live in the world of information overload. So suddenly we're no longer in a space where we as marketers get to control the narrative in the same way as it used to be. So
it's
suddenly
a big shift,
massive shift. And it's a shift over a period of time, but think about that. And I mean, James, you're in marketing, you know this very, very well. Suddenly you're no longer framing your story to in its perfect way. You're actually opening the doors to who your organization is, allowing people to see who you are and connecting with people in a different way. And suddenly you're going, okay, you know, what is it you know about us? You know who we are. Now you want to know something more specific. So it's my job to learn a fair amount about you, just like you've learned about me. And the level of connection between organizations and you and the person you're marketing to has shifted completely. Now you are having to go onto a deeper level. Now a flyer with your top 5 points of who you are doesn't really cut it. There's a level of authenticity required in marketing that took a while for some people to catch on. And so people, it's all about the people. Like, if you don't know the people that you're talking to the way that they know you, you're already behind the eight ball, quite considerably behind the eight ball. And that's going to need to shift if you want to communicate the right thing to the right person at the right time. You're going to need to know them. And so marketing has shifted more and more into that space. And I think that's a really good thing, because you're bringing in another skill set within to marketing. And that's not just communicating me talking to you, that's me listening to you as well. And when you say digital marketing that puts people first, absolutely that. It's like, who are these people? What are their interests? Are we someone who could get on and communicate? Okay, let's begin to build a relationship with this community. And so that's where I believe it's really important.
Yeah, so it used to be you're standing on top of a building with a loudhailer yelling at people, and now you're standing on the street corner chatting with people.
It's shifted so completely. And if you go back and, you know, look at old school marketing campaigns and the way companies used to interact with people pre-social media and social media, which I'm sure Beth will also reference, a whole nother world of marketing. But pre all of that, that's the way that marketing used to be. No wonder people didn't really like us. We were a bit annoying.
You mentioned right at the start around that you were concerned about the ethics of marketing. And is that what it was?
It was partly that. It was partly, just like very not self-aware about their marketing space in the world or in business. But it was also it brought in a lot of psychology elements into marketing. Okay, let's work out, you know, needs versus wants. Let's get people to want this or move into this space or that. And when I started studying, it was pre the GFC. We were in more of a consumerist culture than we are currently in. We're shifting to a more sustainable, trying to live in a more sustainable way. And we were a bit back then, but we're much more into that space now. And just ethically, there was a level of manipulation involved in trying to persuade people to do something that they didn't necessarily want to do before you started talking to them. That was probably more the ethics I'm speaking about in marketing. It was unnecessary, because if you knew what they really wanted, you could provide that. But that wasn't the way that we used to do it as much.
I think you put your finger on it there. If you're ever trying to convince someone to do something they don't want to do, you've got a problem.
Beyond a boundary. And I wasn't sure realistically in real life how many times I'd have to do that in my job.
But I just think, like, if you're shouting off a building, if your only avenue is to shout off the building and just hope some of it drops, you know, some of your message, compared to today, where you can pick a very specific platform to reach a very specific audience. Like, I do think our tools these days are so much more specific, which then means we see more specific results. And so companies can either be very happy or unhappy with the results, because we've actually only targeted the people that we're supposed to target. So I do think, like, they had a little bit of a harder job back in the day of just they going, did. Well, we'll put the megaphone out there.
So Beth, that did mean, if you're with the megaphone, it means you're talking, you might be talking to a thousand people down, you know, on the street, and 950 of them are the wrong person.
Absolutely.
And this is what television advertising was. I'm advertising insurance. Mm. well, print advertising, television, radio. Yeah, I'm advertising insurance to children.
Yes.
Because kids are watching that show. You know, it's like it's so much wastage. Mm. But when you add to that, it's also top of line sort of this is what we do, this is who we are.
Mm.
Not a lot of call to action and not a lot of detail. It's just, hey, here we are,
yeah.
Which is fine. It's just not nuanced. It's not educating and it's not in engaging and necessarily pulling many leads at the bottom of the funnel. You haven't really put people first in that process.
No.
And what you're saying, Beth, is that we now have technology that not only allows us to say the right things, mm. but we can talk to the right people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think marketing had to have gotten smarter because in print days, you paid for a full page ad, for example, in the first top 10 pages because a lot of things were based on assumption. We assumed that everyone would get through the first 10 pages of a newspaper, but when you delivered them to the door of homes every weekend, we didn't know if people even grabbed and took them inside or threw them in the bin or opened them, or a lot of things were made on assumptions. And the reason that the print to online revenue even closed at all, that gap closed and print declined and digital advertising started rising, was because companies who wanted their ads to be seen by specific audiences were all of a sudden being given real data that said 400 people saw your ad, as opposed to the 800,000 print newspapers we've just assumed have seen your ad. And it went from like a big company and big airline companies paying 50 grand in the first 10 pages to have one ad for 1 week to companies saying, well, I'm not going to pay that for online because I can see only 400 people have seen my ad. And so there started being this tension between, what we could assume people were seeing, the 800,000 circulation figures. We just assumed they all read that paper. Companies all of a sudden were like, well, you can't provide us with that same large data, so we're not going to pay that anymore.
Yeah. So let's talk about data because for me, I did my degree in marketing in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I know I don't look that old. No.
Definitely don't.
And it was pre Google.
Yeah.
So, search didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we started the Online Co in 2009, the world had changed. And because I love marketing, but then I was like, oh, real-time data. Actual numbers of leads, actual numbers of impressions and actual numbers of people that have come to my website. It was like two halves of a whole click together. I'm like, marketing's good, but digital marketing's awesome, because of data.
Yeah, it changed everything. I remember once when I was studying a little bit about Facebook, when it brought out more of its, because it didn't exist when I was first at uni, and then when I think it had just started to come out, and then it said, oh, they're going to be advertising. And I had to write a paper on how I imagined Facebook would use advertising in its future because it was just so new. Wow. And I remember having to write this paper at uni, but I do also remember much later studying a little bit about their advertising and big data. They just brought out this ability to really drill down in the way that users, like to a specific user. And to prove this point, the person that was showing us the tutorial, he literally targeted specifically each one of us with our own advert, even though 30 of us were in a room, and to show us how easy it was to target specifically one person. So narrowing down our things, we've been seeing an advert for over 3 days on our social channels, which we were the only ones seeing it because that's how he'd set it up. To show us that's how it could work. And we went, what?
Well, that's got a scary 100%. Side to it. And and Facebook has walked back a long way from
you remember
from
that? That.
And so has Google. Yeah. Yeah. The good old bad old days.
So true.
Beth, one of your mottos is data is key. In fact, Lucy was suggesting you should get a T-shirt made out of saying data is key. You spend a fair bit of time in data these days?
Yes. I I have a permanent data tab open. But I think I wasn't always this way either. I think I did learn the hard way. I think because, again, like you both, I grew up and studied and started learning when data wasn't available. And so I do think a lot of things were by, you know, what you were told or intuition or, and I don't think that necessarily those things those things definitely don't get cancelled out because of data. If anything, data strengthens, you know, your kind of base thought, or it confirms if the audience want what you're providing them. And, you know, I think there's still a long way for a lot of people in workplaces in general when it comes to data. I still think the thinking is a lot of like, well, I feel this way, so I feel like other people will feel this way about the message or the story we're trying to portray. And then if you actually go and look at the data, it just never lies. That's the thing, is that we have done surveys before where people have told us what their interest areas are, and then we've matched it against data that we've received. And it's funny how sometimes people are quite aspirational as to their interest areas and what they wish their interest areas were, which is always news and politics and, you know, family and relationships. But in the background, all these guilty pleasures of entertainment TV and reality TV and celebrity culture, it always dominates. So, which is fine. We can all, like, you know, tell ourselves these little stories. But I think it's, you know, when you talk about putting people first, you know, what we present to people is not about us. Like, we come and we work in a organization for a time, and with that organization's mission and that organization's content. And so how do you get that out to the right people, and how do you tell that story in the right way? How you tell it to a 18, 20 year old is going to be very different how you tell it to a 50, 55 year old. And then everyone in between. And so data just breaks it down for you. It tells you exactly, you know, the demographic, the age groups, the location they're in. It tells you the actual content they're clicking on. And not in a, you know, we at Hope try to be as non-invasive, and we don't track any specifics, but we go look at the data so that we go, you know, if it's all faith stories that our audience are wanting, then provide those things rather than, you know, we've got some own special interests areas that we're like, oh, these are just our passion projects and we want to force these onto people. It was the same with platforms and marketing in general, that instead of trying to make the platforms you want to work for the people, be on the platforms they're already on and that are already working. And they will change over time. You know, who's on MySpace now? There's no point trying to put all your resources into MySpace if no one's there, but you're still trying to make it happen. And then the rising one.
I wonder if my kids know what MySpace is.
They'll probably come to you one day. They'll probably come to you one day and say, I've got this really good idea to add music to
social media.
Done that.
And they're all wearing, they're all wearing the 90s clothes and loving Friends again anyway. So, maybe they'll bring MySpace back. You never know.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. We'd be pushing 20 years now. Maybe it's due for a resurgence.
It could be.
you were talking actually there, Beth, about testing assumptions. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this idea. And the thing that I like, well, I assume everyone likes that, but that's often not true, but there might be a large group of people that like the same things I like. But digital, Lucy, allows you to go, I'm going to push that out and I'm going to get slapped in the face if I'm wrong very fast, or if I'm right, hooray.
I think it can be very, especially if you are kind of someone who's like, I think this is, you have a really good idea in marketing, for example, you're like, this could be a really good campaign, this could really work. And you formulate that campaign based on a couple of assumptions, and then you go to the data, the digital data. You know, I'll say to Beth, okay, can we pull data on this? And she'll just be like, it's just I know this is what we think our people are doing, but this is not actually what our people are doing. And you have to make a choice then as a marketer to go down the path of being data driven or saying like, no, this could work. Let's see if we can expand how people are exploring this. And often I think data is really important and we have to use it well. But I think digital, especially in digital, I think that there are ways that you can combine that with expertise and intuition that you already have. And I think that's when you come up with really, really good campaigns. Because we have a mission and a vision statement here in our organization. Now, sometimes what people are looking for and saying that they're looking for and what's highest on their thing that they want isn't necessarily aligned or, you know, part of our specific mission and vision. So even though we know that's the thing people are looking for the most, we might still not push that because we're trying to. So the key is to not make assumptions and the key is to bring in this data, but you also have to bring in your extensive knowledge of your mission and organization, because in digital, otherwise every single thing that anyone does on digital will be the same because a lot of the data we're getting is very similar. So you still bring your unique story and your unique message and your unique contribution to the space, but you tie it in and align it with the data that you're getting on a day-to-day basis. So you're kind of bringing the two together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's interesting because listeners to this podcast who live in Sydney might know 103.2 as the Christian radio station. However, roughly 40% of your listeners profess to not have a faith. It's very interesting. And then when we're talking about marketing, you're saying that there's this data that might say people want to talk about this and we don't all want to do the same thing. Part of marketing is a point of difference. You know, there's this saying you're meant to zig when everyone else is zagging. And in the radio industry, everyone's doing the shock jock thing. And you guys are doing wholesome content. And a large proportion, I mean, we're talking 300,000 plus people per month, are listening to your content that don't share your beliefs.
Yeah. It's massive.
So how does that align? You know, do you have thoughts on being different, poking out and going a different way to the current in order to create an engaged audience?
I mean, Beth, you speak to that first. I'll follow up.
Yeah, I think what you were saying there about, so when we see the data and we see that everyone is into like reality TV and movies and celebrity culture, we're not going to start becoming the radio station for just, you know, hot news on celebrities. That's not who we are. What Lucy said, we have a mission statement. And so we go, well, if people are still interested in entertainment, what is our point of difference? And just one example is Laura Bennett, who does afternoons. She does movie reviews. So she still goes and reviews all the major films, but she puts a Christian perspective to it. She finds, you know, like we also make sure that the ratings on the films, we kind of let people know if there's some things they should look out for or not. And so that, you know, that's just one example, but I think it's not about shying away from the things that everyone else is talking about just because it's maybe a film that is not really like, you know, we don't just review Christian films. And I think that also speaks to the audience that is, you know, a large portion who don't profess to have faith, but are interested in clean content for their kids, are interested in exploring faith or wholesome content.
I think wholesome content's a big deal because, you know, we obviously won't name them, but there's plenty of kind of grubby stuff out there. And if you're a parent with your kids in the car taking them to school, you don't want that on the radio
station. At all. And one thing that's really interesting is that, and again, you would know this from marketing for as many years as you have, but when you are outlining a point of difference, even if it's something that potentially could be divisive, like, so For example, the fact that we are a Christian radio station. When you outline that at the very beginning, that doesn't have to remove or reduce the option for other people to come connect, join in, and give space for that. But sometimes if you don't have any point of difference or positioning at all, and you try and be something for every single person, you end up not having any real connection or with your community at all. So normally people are actually absolutely fine if you just state, you know, very honestly and authentically, this is who we are, but we're for everyone. So please come connect, be a part of what we do. And so a big mistake some people can make in marketing is trying not to state who they are because they're worried that someone might not like it. But you end up actually having the opposite happen and no one likes you.
Yeah. No one likes you because
you don't stand for anything.
Yeah, you're like a potato soup. You just kind of bland and beige and got no flavor.
It sounds counterintuitive, but it's often the way that it works.
Yeah, and what it does, because we keep coming back to this ethics point, you're allowing people to opt in because you're clear, but you're allowing people to opt
absolutely
out.
Absolutely, yes.
So I don't like this. I don't want to engage with it. That's no worries. I do like this. I'm going to opt in. Well, you're welcome. Yeah. And healthy marketing is probably like that.
Yeah.
Whether you're a lawyer or an electrician or whatever it is you do, to say, hey, this is who we are. This is who we stand for. Mm-hmm. Come and join us or not.
Yeah.
You know?
True.
I've heard it said that your business might be more defined by who you're not appealing to than who you are. Sometimes that's an interesting perspective.
And I think in this day and age as well, we're also tired of being tricked and scammed and we just want transparency.
Yes.
And I think, the opt-in, opt-out part, I think we just appreciate it because we're like, well, they are, you know, they're very clear about who they are. You know, no one's being forced to listen to Hope, for example. We're very passionate about making sure that we're transparent about who we are. And when we provide content, we try to make sure we're as transparent as possible about, the actual content and what people are about to consume in whatever form, whether it's entertainment or devotions or we never try to trick anyone into reading it.
Absolutely.
Or watching or listening.
No. So the problem with clickbait is essentially it backfires you in the long term. You get a short term click and a long term sort of disaffected user is like, oh, them again. I'll pass.
Try and filter every piece of content that we put up digitally and Beth is someone who monitors that very closely through our mission and value statements. And if they don't align with that, we don't put them up, even if it could get us very quickly to go viral in one area. And that is because consistency over a long period of time, if you are who you say you are, that actually has significant amount of standing in the industry that we're in, even more than it used to be. So it's very important to have that level of integrity in the long term. Because people respect that.
Yeah, and James, what you said about clickbait, we have tried to be very intentional about not doing clickbait. There's a difference between keywords and making sure it's like a shock kind of headline to grab you in. And sometimes that's hard because you know that some of the more shocking clickbait headlines you could come up with would get a very short-term a short-term result. But for the short term, it would get the numbers up. So sometimes it is hard to go make a choice where you're like, well, we have to be more transparent and we don't want to trick people into consuming this piece of content. But it may not get the, there's high kind of vanity clicks to start.
So one of the things I've learned in my career, and it was really summarized for me in a recent textbook I read, is this idea that a short-term approach to marketing is unwise always.
Yeah.
It's always unwise. And, we talk about clients we don't deal with. If we've got people that want very short-term results, it's like, well, that's problematic on a number of levels because maybe we end up compromising ethically to get your result. Or maybe we're just kind of harming your business because we're doing things that just, you know, get you some leads today and then they fall over. Or maybe we're getting you low quality leads. Or, you know, the short-termism is, and I think data's actually given us this. If I do this, I get this result tomorrow. Great, we should do more of that.
Yeah.
Whereas we don't tend not to look at the 12-month or the five-year piece of saying, hey, we've done good work, engaging work, created our brand, built on our brand, delivered on our promises over time, and now people love us and stay with us, and we've built a successful business. We've taken data's actually, that's the bad side of data. And a move away from building a brand on trust.
It's why I don't think AI could ever determine your marketing strategy. There's too many other human factors at play. It can help.
Yes. Well, AI is a good tool. It's a good servant. It's not a very good master. Don't, use it as a helper. So in full transparency, the Online Co has worked with you guys for a couple of years now. And we love working with you guys. One of the things is that we maybe laugh more in meetings with you guys than any other client. I don't know what it is about your – it must be a great culture to work in down there. You've got quite a few people with great senses of humour, including yourselves. Tell me how it is, you know, when – we've got small business owners listening to this and we've got marketing professionals like yourselves listening to this. What's your thoughts on when to – use somebody in-house, which is you guys, and when to use somebody out-house?
It's a great question. There's a lot of the marketing has shifted as well in terms of you don't really these days, even in larger organizations, have big marketing departments anymore. You can have a few people in marketing, but often you have to find that balance between outsourcing what you need and doing things in-house when you need to, like from a funding point of view. So resources, especially if you're not for profit, is something to explore. Another thing that's really interesting is just like when you're in an organization and you've got a bunch of stuff you need to do, like it's working out who is the best person to do that job anyway. You might not have the skills, let alone the resources, but the skills, and you might need to bring people in to support that. That's also, you know, a really valid way of looking into who's going to do what within your marketing department or within your digital department. I think resources is a significant one, but also onboarding. Like, James, you were very patient with us as we explained some of the complexities around marketing for a media organization, around our mission and our values, around sometimes the niche appeal for some of the stuff that we do. You have to think about the length of time it's going to take to bring an organization, onboard an organization into some of the ways that you work. And sometimes that time it takes to bring in onboard someone externally could actually, it's just too long for you to get the project that you need done. So that's another. So if you're looking to build relationships with organizations long term, then it's kind of worth it. But if it's only a very short term thing, maybe bring it in-house, because explaining yourself and possibly being misunderstood can actually end up taking longer.
Beth, do you think there's such a thing these days as a digital marketing expert?
I guess you can be an expert in the sense that you understand like the concept. Like I think Lucy is a digital marketing expert. I think she has a lot of skills, a lot of knowledge, and like really is able to kind of put that out across all the different areas she has to speak into, and then also all the different people she has to work with. So I think you can have an expert, but I don't think that you can have one person to do digital marketing, because it's a beast and it's never ending. It's 24 hours. It's 365 days of the year. Content never stops, and digital, whether it's social media or the website, apps and podcasts, people are just wanting more and more and more. You can drop an entire episode, series of a podcast, you know, or a Netflix show, and people will consume it in, you know, a day or two. And then they're looking for a new season, which is not how we used to consume content, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago either. And so I think, you know, thinking of my kind of pros and cons of why you would have one person as opposed to an agency, is that a person in-house is very, like, closely, you know, they're in the bubble, they're in the world, they're passionate about it, and they're kind of, like, on call during working hours. But then an agency brings, like what Lucy was saying, all that professional expertise from different people, but also you're covered all year round. And I think that it's actually a mix of both. So, you know, what I do love about working with Online Co is that we have you guys to cover the bulk of what we need, because we just don't have the time and resources and people to do it. But then when there's more immediate things, or there's things that, you know, we just kind of know, like, so well, we can do that ourselves as well. So I think a kind of a collaboration is a good way to go about it, whether you have, you know, one person in your organization or five people in your team, and then, you know, working, like, closely with an agency. So I think we found it a positive experience, because Lucy and I did try to find an individual to do it, and for the time we were looking, we were covering it, but we were also doing three other kind of jobs, and we were so overwhelmed by it. It's so time consuming to try and cover every platform you think you should be on. So I feel like that burden has gone away now.
That's my question around an expert. So I think, if I was to summarise, there's a fractional element of hiring an agency. So you're not hiring a full-time person. You're hiring somebody for a few hours a month who has the skill to go in and make a Google AdWords campaign or a social posting campaign top-notch, but they don't need a full-time wage to do that. But then there's the expertise in terms of, you know, the Google algorithm is changing all the time, and you can't be on top of the Google algorithm plus the Pinterest algorithm plus the Facebook plus the Instagram. You just can't be on top of all of that.
I think that's where you start to find yourself under the desk as you
follow
that realization of, I'm not keeping up, and this is, you know, are we reaching anybody? And you're going well 1 second, and then you, like, fail the next minute. You know, it's a roller coaster trying to do it on your own, I think.
As an industry, I honestly think we are changing so fast and so quick. It's almost like we're resetting every time. Everything that worked 3 or 4 months ago isn't necessarily working now. And then, so we had that with Facebook and social media, but then we also had a completely life-changing event take place in 2020 to 2022 in COVID. That changed everything. We're now looking, it's March 2023, and we're looking at anti-branding as a concept beginning to rise to the surface. That's basically no branding at all, because everybody's fed up of something polished, and they just want something simple and clean. They don't want to be confused. They want something authentic. They want something they can read really easily. They don't want anything clever or smart or fancy with all the different things that we put in even 10 years ago. The cultures are constantly changing in marketing because people don't want to wade through 5 different really cool little elements to get to the bit that you're trying to say, because they're too tired and they're too overwhelmed and life is too difficult right now. Say what you want to say and let me choose. And suddenly we're moving into a different space again. And I mean, I love that, but it means that we're all coming from the set often from that level playing field. We can say with our experience, yes, we're experts in this, but honestly, it changes every few months and we have to kind of relearn. And so you have to be really good at problem solving and really flexible to everything that's changing in order to kind of stay in the industry, which is obviously what you guys did in, you know, in the digital marketing, which you're having to do probably every single week.
Yeah, it's a topic in every single team meeting every week. Yeah. it's just the nature of the Absolutely. Industry.
Yeah.
One last question. If you could go back and speak to yourself 10 years ago, Beth, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, two short pieces of advice. One, I did think about this. One was don't write status updates that no one's interested in, because back in the day, Facebook used to ask you, you know, how are you feeling or what are you doing? And we used to write the most mundane, random things. So glad that stopped. But I think for me, what I've learned is don't fear what's next. It doesn't mean you have to jump on board it. It doesn't mean you have to incorporate it into your strategy or use it necessarily. But journalists were afraid of Twitter because it was like if they were afraid that they were going to take away our jobs, because if every day untrained people could break news, what do we do? And I watched organizations who started incorporating Twitter and using it in journalism in a really clever way, and they thrived. And so I think, and I've seen time and time again, that every new technology that comes, the organizations that are excited about it and use it, and also there's some technology that fizzles out or some social media platforms that are terrible, shouldn't use them. But the thing is, like, don't get that. I think there is this anxiety of, oh, you know, ChatGPT is out now, so what are writers going to do? And there's always something new that you can get worried about. But the thing with digital is there's the good and the bad of it, no matter what. We've seen how social media has been like revolutionary for some countries, but we've seen how Facebook has also, you know, for Australia, turning off news for a week. Like, how can you rely on a tool that can just unplug you, you know, without any warning? So I think it's just don't fear it and just seeing like, okay, well, what's next? What do we do? What's good? What could we use? And so from small business to big company, it's just working out how many resources do you have and like who are you trying to target, and then try and find the platforms you need in order to achieve that.
Yeah, curiosity is a good stance,
Very
isn't
good.
It? Rather than you can be fearful of the tech, or you can be the opposite. You could be like this great big guy. Yeah, I love this new wonderful thing. And, you know, curiosity just says, hey, oh, let's check this out.
Yeah.
Let's see how we can use it. Let's see if we can innovate. Maybe we put it in the bin. But what about you, Lucy?
What advice would you give yourself? Similar to Beth. I think the first thing I'd say is don't worry, Lucy. The majority of people are walking around pretending they know what they're doing. Even as, you know, even higher up in those things. And the reason I say that is because things are changing all the time. And what I thought I could equip myself with, you know, study, learn, you know, which is very, very important base. But what's more important is actually what you said, James. It's about curiosity. It's about being able to trust that what is within you and your ability to problem solve and to learn and to look forward to the future, that's what you really need to carry with you in your work, even more than, you know, the qualification I got for a now redundant, you know, for advertising that is essentially redundant. I think, again, like Beth said, it's not being afraid that what you learned is becoming irrelevant. It's more realizing that the way you learn it and the way you can then implement it is more important. So I'd have probably told myself that and kind of trusted myself a little bit more.
Yes. Yes. Oh, well, that's awesome. Well, Lucy and Beth, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
No worries. Thanks, James.
Your stories and insights have been fascinating.
Always love having a chat with you, James. We always take up too much of your time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Well, I hope you found today's episode informative. I know that most businesses struggle with their digital marketing, so that's why we've developed a process over the past 10 years to put together robust and holistic digital marketing strategies to help your businesses grow. If you need help with your digital marketing, just Google The Online Co and click on the red button to book a quick chat. We'd love to have a speak to you. speak with you and see how we can best help. Take care, everyone.